This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for being with us this morning. Almost 70 years ago, the age of nuclear warfare formally began with the atomic bombs the United States dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It didn't take long as the Cold War descended across the world for the two superpowers, the U.S. and the USSR, to amass huge stockpiles of nuclear weapons. You may be old enough to remember fallout shelters and school drills in case of a Russian attack. But almost as long as there have been weapons of this magnitude in the world, there have been people protesting their existence and people working to eradicate them. As our next guest will attest, we've been successful in drastically reducing the numbers of nuclear ordnance and weaponry in the world, but he will also say that we have a long way to go to get the number to zero. Joseph Cerincione is the president of Plowshares Fund. It's a publicly supported foundation established 35 years ago that works to eradicate nuclear weapons around the world. Cerincione was in Milwaukee earlier this week to speak at the Milwaukee Rotary Club, and he took some time out of his schedule to talk with us as well. He joins me in the studio now. Joe, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you very much, Bonnie. It's my pleasure to be here.
Considering all of the threats that face the world, why should eliminating nuclear weapons be at the top of the list?
Yeah. Well, we certainly have no shortage of challenges for our nation, in our personal lives, our families. But of all the challenges we face, only two threaten destruction on a planetary scale: global warming and nuclear weapons. Both of these are caused by machines that we've built. Both of them could destroy everything else that we've built. The good news is that both of these threats are preventable, reversible even, but they require leaders with a new way of thinking and the courage to act, because in the end, these are really political considerations. Although it doesn't affect an individual's immediate life, it could, in a catastrophic scenario, affect everything. That's why you got to pay attention.
But isn't it the case a little bit that the genie is already out of the bottle? We know how to make these. Lots of people know how to make at least rudimentary nuclear weapons. How do we put the genie back in the bottle?
We've done it repeatedly. We know how to make a lot of really awful things. We know how to make chemical weapons. Most of the countries in the world have avowed never to make chemical weapons again. We used to have the largest chemical arsenal in the world. We've destroyed it. Lots of countries know how to make biological weapons. We used to have the best biological weapons in the world, enough toxins to kill every man, woman, child, and most food crops in the world. We got rid of them and signed a treaty that most countries have adhered to, agreeing not to do it. So you're seeing this in certain of these horror weapons, chemical and biological. You're seeing us put the genie in the bottle, and you're seeing it in nuclear. Back when I started doing this work in the 1980s, we had about 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world. We've been steadily reducing ever since then. We're down to 16,000. There are actually fewer nuclear weapons in the world every year. There are fewer countries pursuing these weapons. More countries have given up nuclear weapons and nuclear programs in the last 30 years than have tried to get them. So the arrow is moving towards fewer and fewer nuclear weapons. It's a question of pace. When you're running away from a forest fire, direction is important, but it's really speed that matters. Can you get to safety quicker than catastrophe can overcome you?
Considering you've already achieved a great deal of your goal, which is complete elimination of nuclear weapons, and we're down to this 16,000 or so.
Yeah.
So how do we go from there? Where do we start? Do we start with the U.S. and reducing our stockpiles, or are we at a greater risk for rogue states having gotten their hands on nuclear weapons that are out in the black market?
Well, experts break this down into three threats. And to give credit to President Obama, he sees it this way, and he's put in place a policy that, at least on paper, attempts to deal with all three threats simultaneously. Number one is the risk of nuclear terrorism. What if ISIS gets its hands on nuclear material from the loose stockpiles in Russia or from cooperative officials in Pakistan? Nuclear terrorism, number one threat. Officially, in the U.S. national security strategy, the number one threat to the nation is nuclear terrorism. Number two is the threat of new countries getting these weapons. Iran and North Korea, of course, are at the top of that list. In fact, they're the only list. You have to stop them from getting it, or else more and more countries might get them. And then third is the danger from the weapons that exist, an accident. you got to be a real optimist to think that you can keep 16,000 nuclear weapons in fallible human hands and nothing is going to happen. Human beings make mistakes. Switches are pushed by accident. Fingers slip. Miscalculations are made. And in the case of a nuclear weapon, it'll be catastrophic. So you have to have a plan that addresses all of those. And it turns out you have to do them simultaneously. So the U.S. and Russia have the most nuclear weapons in the world. 95% of all the weapons are held by the U.S. and Russia, pretty much divided evenly. So you got to reduce them first in order to get the other countries that just have a few dozen, a few hundred, to join the crowd. And doing that, making progress on disarmament, helps build the international cooperation you need to enact laws and spend money to secure all the nuclear materials around the world so that terrorists can't get them, and to put in place sanctioned regimes to stop new countries from getting the weapons. And when you do that, when you build up the confidence, the security that new countries aren't going to get them, that in turn feeds back and gives the countries that are giving up these weapons the confidence to continue that path. So it's a positive feedback loop that you have to keep doing over and over again.
How is it working with Russia right now, though? I mean, things with Putin are a little tense for all kinds of reasons.
In this particular area, it's a dead stop. Russia does not want to engage in negotiations to reduce its nuclear stockpile. We've had those kinds of periods before, but we continue the dialogue. Even in the coldest days of the Cold War, the leaders talked to each other. I mean, this was Ronald Reagan's lesson. I mean, even as he was denouncing the evil empire, he was negotiating with the Russians on very important arms control treaties. Ronald Reagan was the greatest arms control president of all. He achieved agreements with Russia that cut both sides' nuclear stockpiles in half. In half. This was a huge victory, even when the Cold War was still raging. So that's the historic lesson we look at. And we keep going because we know that things change. The policies that we've put in place against Putin since his invasion of Ukraine, since his seizure of Crimea, have punished him severely. The Russian economy is suffering. Russia is isolated in the world. You got to hope that that kind of pressure will yield to some kind of change, if not this year, then next year. And you got to be ready to take advantage of that.
One of the problems, I think, in reducing nuclear weapons is that they are a big business.
Mm-hmm.
Militaries ask for them.
Mm-hmm.
They want the so-called deterrent of a nuclear arsenal. And defense contractors make a lot of money for shareholders by building them.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get that loop broken?
And let me add one more. The political support from them from states where they produce jobs. So one of the biggest problems we have is a group called the ICBM Caucus. It sounds weird, but there is a group in Congress composed of the senators from states where there are ICBM bases, long-range missile bases, Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, et cetera. And they get about, 2,000 jobs out of those bases, and they don't want to lose them. So those senators will block arms control treaties that threaten to cut those missiles. And this is a real political problem. So the way you do this, you go right at the economic drivers for this, offering, for example, those states an alternative revenue stream. Is there something else we can do with those bases? Is there a way to have those military personnel remain and do something more useful to the country than sitting in underground silos for 24-hour shifts waiting to push a button they know they're never going to push? You wonder why we have a morale problem with the ICBM force? It is a dead-end job. Can't we give those guys, highly trained, something better to do? And fortunately, what's going on right now is that there's a shrinkage of the defense budget. So the military has no problem spending money on nuclear weapons or missile defense systems as long as the pie is growing, as long as everybody's getting what they want. But the pie is not growing anymore. With the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan and Iraq, the defense budget is going to be going down for the foreseeable future. That means it forces choices. And when the Joint Chiefs have to choose, they don't choose nuclear. They choose things they actually use, ships and planes and tanks. I used to work on the House Armed Services Committee in the 80s under Les Aspin, who was then chairman of that committee. And every year we would put on an amendment on the floor to Ronald Reagan's budget where we cut about $1 billion from the missile defense program, the so-called Star Wars program. And we shifted it to things that the chiefs really wanted, including good old Oshkosh trucks. So conventional capabilities that were being underfunded in the budget. We took the nuclear money and shifted it over there. That's the kind of dynamic we're seeing now among the Joint Chiefs, and I think is going to continue in the future. So this budget squeeze becomes a policy lever, a way to modernize our nuclear policy, take it out of the Cold War, and adjust it for the 21st century.
So do you see that happening in this budget cycle that's beginning now?
Yes, I do. And you see people complaining about it. So just a couple of weeks ago, the Secretary of the Navy, Mr. Malbus, said we have to have a debate about the cost of the nuclear triad. And here's why. Over the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to be making decisions on funding the next generation of nuclear weapons. All those nuclear weapons we built during the Reagan buildup, that was the last wave of nuclear modernization, they're coming to the end of their operational lives. Weapons, that is missiles, bombers, subs, wear out like cars. So we know they're going to be leaving service in the 2020s sometime. So with these big kinds of systems, if you want to replace them, you got to start now. Well, there's money in the budget to start a new generation of subs, a new replacement ICBM, a new bomber, a new cruise missile for the bomber, new warheads for all these things, new plants to build. In other words, we're about to decide whether we want to recapitulate the Cold War arsenal for the next 50 years. Estimated cost, $1 trillion just over the next 30, which is about as far out as you can see. We're going to spend in the next decade over $570 billion on nuclear weapons and related programs. Do we want to do that? What don't we fund? So the Secretary of the Navy is saying, I need help. If we go ahead with this nuclear sub program, we're going to build 12 new subs, I'm not going to have enough money to build my conventional ships. It'll take half of my shipbuilding budget to build these nuclear subs, which is true. So you got to choose. His option is to add money to the Navy budget, which the Air Force and the Army aren't too crazy about. But this fight is now beginning to happen. So pay attention. Over the next couple of years, we're going to make decisions that could affect us for the next 50. And if you're somebody listening to this program under 25, you're going to get the bill. It's not me. I'm going to be retired. I'm going to be in a lake someplace. The under 25 generation, you got to pay attention because Congress is making decisions that's going to affect your tax bill for the rest of your lives.
So how is Plowshares Fund hoping to redirect this debate and possibly rejigger where the money's going?
Well, the first thing you do is to call attention to the problem. So my colleague, Tom Colina, who's our policy director, just published a terrific new report called The Unaffordable Arsenal. So if you Google the unaffordable arsenal, you'll get this report, and it details the train wreck that's about to happen. With Plowshares Fund, what we do is we raise money from generous individuals and then give it out as grants to the smartest people we can find with the best ideas on how to deal with these problems. And then what we do is we knit them together so that we don't just give them the grants and let them go do their thing. We put them together into a network so we have a coordinated strategy on the nuclear budget, on Iran, on stopping new states from getting weapons, and we leverage our resources for maximum impact.
How positive are you that this is having an effect, and it's having the effect that you want, which is the complete elimination of nuclear weapons?
Well, this is a long haul. So when you're dealing with a problem like this, or climate change, or poverty, or education, it takes decades to address these problems. So you got to have a strategy that keeps your eye on the horizon, keeps you going in the right direction, but takes advantage and makes gains, sometimes incremental, every year. And that's what we see happening. Every year we see the Congress acting, for example, to cut this program or that program. We haven't reached the tipping point yet where they're willing to revise the whole agenda, but we're chipping away at the problem. And I think we've already won the debate in the national security elite. There is a bipartisan consensus that nuclear weapons, whatever their benefits during the Cold War, are now more of a liability than an asset, and that we need to shift our emphasis away from them and focus on stopping nuclear terrorism, stopping new states, and that involves giving up our own weapons. That's a good thing. These are the only weapons that can destroy us as a nation. We'd be much better off if there were far fewer of these and eventually none of these weapons. We've won that debate in the national security elite. We're now fighting the bureaucracy, the inertia that keeps this thing going, the jobs, the money, the political advantage. So you got to fight the politics of this too in order to advance this agenda. And you got to keep it bipartisan. You can't take the side of one party or the other. You got to keep that spirit going.
Do you see that overcoming that inertia the greatest impedance to achieving these goals?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the military doesn't care that much about them. Speaking broadly, there are certain sectors that are tied directly to the weapons that obviously want to keep their officer billets and their contracts going. But overall, the military has already decided, for example, that we can do with one-third fewer weapons. We could cut our nuclear arsenal by 33% tomorrow, and it wouldn't affect any mission. The only thing that's standing in the way is the politics of it. Can the president just do that if the Russians don't go along? Can you make an independent cut? Ronald Reagan did. George H.W. Bush did. He eliminated 14,000 nuclear weapons in 1 month in 1991. But it's hard for a Democrat to do it because they get attacked so much these days. So it's really the politics and the bureaucracy that's blocking at this point, not national security.
So are you overall optimistic?
I am. I am optimistic, but not without a fight. This isn't going to happen automatically. You know, it's like anything in this world. If you want it, you have to go out and get it. You have to go push it. You have to go mobilize. You got to be smart. You got to know who your friends are. You got to support them. You got to build a common strategy. You have to build calming messages because there are always people trying to block you. So it doesn't come easy. It doesn't come without a struggle, but it's coming.
In the short term, what are some of the things you're going to be focusing on, say, in the next year?
Well, besides the nuclear budget, it's Iran. Iran is the next big policy opportunity that's out there. We are real close to getting a deal with Iran to make sure that we shut down that country's nuclear program, that it's used only for the peaceful purposes, which is what Iran claims, and that they can't turn that into a bomb-making program, at least not quickly, at least not without us seeing them do it and having the opportunity to stop it. The deadline for negotiations, this is a negotiation that's taking place with six powers, not just the U.S., and Iran, is November 24th. I'm optimistic that we're going to see a breakthrough in those talks in the next few weeks, and we may be looking at an historic change, the first time we've been able to successfully negotiate a comprehensive deal with Iran.
And what is the outflow from that? How do you see that affecting policy in the Middle East?
Well, first of all, you're stopping that country's nuclear program. And if you can do that, you really could be looking at the end of the wave of proliferation that has spread since Hiroshima 70 years ago. People say that you have to worry about countries like Iran and North Korea. Well, there are no countries like Iran and North Korea. There's only Iran and North Korea. North Korea, we've confined them. They've got a small program, maybe enough material for six weapons, isolated, a pariah nation, not a model for anybody. Iran is on the cusp of whether they could get a bomb or not. You stop them, you turn them around, that sends a hugely positive message throughout the world. And in fact, if you don't stop them, then you risk other countries in the region getting the weapons. So a success there is huge for nuclear policy across the globe. But it's more important, actually, than that. One of the reasons I'm optimistic about a deal is I see what's happening in the region actually driving the two sides together. The Middle East is in chaos right now. Iran is one of the few stable nations there. They are our adversary. We're never going to be BFFs with Iran. It's going to take a long time to resolve our differences, but we may have a method now for managing our differences, just the way we did with other countries, China, Russia, etc., because we have overlapping strategic objectives. Both Iran and the United States want to see a stable Afghanistan. We cooperated with Iran in 2001 to overthrow the Taliban, for example. Can we do that again? Both have an interest in a stable Iraq. We both have an interest in stopping ISIS. We both have an interest in ending the conflict in Syria. So if you can get a nuclear deal, this becomes sort of a gateway issue. It allows you to then get to these other issues and start this kind of cooperation. And it also allows us to start addressing some of the other problems we have with Iran, like human rights in that state, like their support for anti-Israel groups. But you can't do any of that without the nuclear deal.
Joseph Cirincione, I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. Thanks for having me on.
Joseph Cirincione is the president of the Global Security Foundation Plowshares Fund. The fund works around the world to eliminate nuclear weapons. Cirincione was in Milwaukee earlier this week to give a talk at the Milwaukee Rotary Club, and he stopped by the studio then. There's more information about the Plowshares Fund at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The Florentine Opera is getting ready for their opening production of the season. We'll talk with some of the cast members and the conductor of the Flying Dutchman when Lake Effect returns right after this.